Hi, everybody. Welcome to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, we are excited to have Dr. Jacob Metcalf. Jake is a consultant and scholar specializing in data and technology ethics. His consulting firm, Ethical Resolve, LLC, provides clients with a complete range of ethics services, including training programs, establishing internal and external ethics committees, market-driven research, and refining corporate messaging. Their goal is to ensure clients can make well-informed, consistent, actionable, and timely business decisions that reflect their values. He's also a researcher at the Data and Society Research Institute, where he is a co-PI on the NSF-funded Pervade project. Jake is dedicated to helping people understand how seemingly small decisions about data technologies can have significant and disparate consequences in society. He received his PhD from the University of California, Santa Cruz in philosophy and has an academic background in applied ethics, particularly in science and technology. And his scholarship in data ethics is recognized as influencing this nascent field around issues of research ethics, policy, and practice in academia. So I just want to welcome Jake so much for kicking us off this year. Thanks, Jake, for coming, being with
us today. Thanks for having me, too.
Yeah, and I just want to say a couple of things about how I know Jake. One is that he and I were at a conference. He was actually speaking at a conference on AI and society in Oslo, Norway last May, and that's where we met. We were in a couple of sessions together and was really impressed with how he thinks about this subject. And so we've been able to do a couple of events together, and I'm so happy you're able to kick us off this year, so thank you. I also want to say that Jake lives in Santa Cruz and didn't have any power this morning because of the storm, so he was able to find a place to be. So I want to acknowledge your extra effort in being with us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So Jake's website is www.ethicalresolve.com, and his Twitter account is @undersequoias, in case anyone is interested in checking him out. So as I always do, this I think is our 15th or 16th year of doing this, and as I always do with our guests, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your journey, I gave the bio, but that doesn't really tell us about your journey in terms of how you decided even to get into this work. So what were some of your inspirations? Jake, if you wouldn't mind starting with that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I came to grad school with the intention of being a professor, and like a lot of students of my generation, my first year on the job market was 2008. So, total offerings of jobs in philosophy went down something like 98% and stayed down for 3 years. So. There's a whole generation of, especially humanities and social sciences students that we had to figure something else out. I'm really happy with what I figured out. Part of that was a family decision to stay in a particular geographical area because we found a wonderful place to live up in the Redwoods in Santa Cruz. Got to talking with some of my former classmates who had either entrepreneurial experience in their past or were getting into entrepreneurship at the time, about 5 or 6 years ago. And, we all had the sense that somewhere on the near horizon, Silicon Valley was going to want leadership on ethics issues, and we thought we'd put out a shingle. And around that same time, I joined Data and Society, which was brand new, as a postdoc on a National Science Foundation grant to help run the Big Data Ethics and Society, the Council for Big Data Ethics and Society, which was a kind of grant that the NSF does to build a scholarly community. So this was when, computer ethics and information ethics those were terms that have been around for a while, but this is right at the beginning of the age of big data, and so data ethics became a topic, and that was sort of the first time it's being really bandied around. So just sort of a happy confluence of events has led me to be able to split my time as sort of an independent academic at Data and Society, which is, we call ourselves, sometimes we call ourselves a think do tank. So unlike other think tanks, we don't really have a specific agenda. We're really research driven. So it's kind of like the most fun academic department you could be in, but social impact focused. And that's a great place to be. But then also, Ethical Resolve has been has offered some really fascinating opportunities, helping clients solve really practical problems that require a philosophical mindset. And that's really been a pleasure, too. My business partner, Ben Room, he has a background in entrepreneurship. And so we've been a pretty good pair in terms of trying to actually create a market.
Yeah, you really are it is nascent, and you really are on the forefront here, and which is part of why I wanted you to be on the show. So before we get into some of these more specific topics around data and ethics, AI for good, what are the troubling issues around AI? There's a lot we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, I just want to talk about AI because, we chose AI to talk about it this year, and, AI is such a huge topic, obviously. We decided to focus in on, AI in society and the implications AI has for society, and particularly today we're talking about the implications it has for ethics. I guess we could look at what ethics has, what ethics has on implications on AI too. I guess we could look at both ways. But I, before we do that, I want to get just your take on AI in general. I know for people on the call, AI is such a big topic, and I wanted just to have you spend a couple of minutes and just a few paragraphs on what is AI. How do we define it? How do you define it?
There's multiple ways of framing what is AI. So, what we have, in the public imagination, AI usually means a general intelligence, right? So, just how humans can solve kind of any problem that gets thrown at us, or we can try at least, right? We reason through many different kinds of cognitive tasks. Some we're better at than others, and some we're pretty bad at. But human intelligence is general, right? We solve a multiplicity of types of problems. Historically, the imagination of what AI is something similar, right? It's an analog to human cognition. It's a general problem solver that acts autonomously. But of course, what we see on the market now is what's often called narrow AI. So that's AI that's trained, it's machine learning that's trained on, it is a sort of a stack of machine learning algorithms that are trained on specific data sets to solve narrow kinds of problems, right? So essentially, you are telling a machine what kind of outcome you would like to have, and you're setting it loose on solving the problem in a computationally efficient way. Now, that computationally efficient there is really important because essentially what it means is the computer is using math to solve a problem using the least number of electrons. It turns out that what's computationally efficient isn't necessarily understandable to human cognition, right? That we solve problems in a different way. So that's an interesting outcome historically, right? As we've thought of AI as being a general problem solver, here we are where all of these new products on the market, all of these services, it turns out that some of the ethical challenges with them are because they solve problems in ways that humans simply couldn't. We wouldn't, right? It's not how we would approach a problem. But yet, it's able, the machine is able to do it rather efficiently on its own terms.
So let me stop you a second. Just to give us some examples. So AI has been around for a long time. I mean, obviously when Google uses algorithms to search. I mean, that's a form of AI, machine learning. So what we're seeing now is a sort of a bustling of abilities of computers, machines, let's say, are able to solve many more narrow problems. Anything from like beating somebody in chess would be an example of that, right? A machine can beat a human in chess, to what Google's doing, to using marketing algorithms to target people in marketing, things like that. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, and I mean, in particular, what we see right now is really the stacking of narrow intelligences. So, you know, some people argue that really how we're going to get to general intelligence is really we're going to have, you know, these really deep stacks of narrow intelligences that will eventually reach a capacity of being able to be called a general intelligence.
When we say general intelligence, it's basically to act the same as a human. That's what we mean by that, right? Similar.
Maybe. It doesn't necessarily – see, there's a little bit of a challenge in saying like a human, right? Because, you know, if we look at the universe of possibilities, there's probably many different kinds of general intelligences. But the idea is autonomously solve whatever problem you throw at it. Right,
yes.
without having to, you know, sort of narrowly train it on a specific domain.
Right. Okay.
It would be capable of handling on its own a general plurality of problems.
Okay, so then you've got general intelligence, you've got narrow intelligence, then you've got super intelligence, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's the existential threat intelligence.
Right. That's going beyond. Okay. And and so of course what we see in the media is robots. That's what we mostly see.
Yeah, and little smart speakers that, you know, buy things for us or tell us what's next in our calendar.
Right. Okay, so before we get into the troubling results of AI, let's talk about some of the issues about AI for good, which is what a lot of the conference, when we went to that conference, that was a lot of what it was about. So could you talk a little bit about that? And then we'll get into some of the troubling things like weaponizing AI and things like that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, AI for good, we could say broadly, is, you know, the attempt to take, you know, these narrow artificial intelligence tools that are increasingly available, you know, usually developed for commercial purposes, and turn them towards social problems. All right, so maybe it's... you know, helping you know, social service recipients being able to, or social welfare recipients, you know, navigate the system better, or it could be helping people, you know, make complaints to their local government about potholes in their neighborhood, right? So, you know, enabling. People, it's often, you know, we could say it's enabling people in a disadvantaged position to, you know, sort of claim their resources using tools that are, you know, are designed for that purpose. Or, you know, we could think of it as, you know, organizations like DataKind, right? They take the, you know, extra time that data scientists in Silicon Valley have, or in New York, or Berlin, or, you know, all of these various tech hubs that DataKind is located at, right? And they, you know, they take that extra time, they find volunteers, and they solve, you know, practical problems for nonprofits. So, for instance, you know, helping environmental organizations build a sensing network to track deforestation, right? You know, lots of nonprofits have giant piles of really useful data that is just kind of underutilized.
Right.
You know, just practically speaking, what does the AI for good community do? It's often helping nonprofits actually put that data to work.
Right, which is awesome, which is great. Some other things are, I mean, just like in healthcare, how we can, I mean, the machine allows scientists, for example, to get data much quicker, like predicting Parkinson's or predicting dementia even. It's just there's just to me there's a ton of potential for being able to get the data faster.
Yes, and especially to interpret it in ways that humans normally can't or wouldn't see, right? You know, that really what commercial AI is built to, or what commercial machine learning is built to do, is to turn inexpensive signals into expensive signals, right? It's to take information that's readily available because we already have it or it's easy to get, and then make inferences about much more expensive sets of data, right? So we, you know, we, if you look at Cambridge Analytica, right, fundamentally that was about a researcher taking cheap signals, which is Facebook profile data, and turning it into expensive signals, which is robust psychological profiles of voters.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, like, normally, you know, if you wanted a robust psychological profile of someone, you're going to have to go out and give them, you know, an hour-long survey run by a trained psychiatrist, right? But if you're able to use a viral quiz to then, you know, infer scientifically validated set of characteristics based off the results of that viral quiz, all of a sudden what you've done is you've turned a really inexpensive signal, which Facebook made readily available, and turn it into something that's actually very expensive. And that is, you know, that's kind of the beauty of machine learning. It's also where we run into lots of problems, because that
right.
inference step is a place where a lot of things can go wrong. It also is where, you know, we have that sort of whiplash experience a lot with AI, where we realize we've disclosed something about ourselves without intending to, because, the really powerful but ultimately really troubling thing that machine learning does is it mm-hmm. steps across the domains of our lived experience in ways that we don't expect. So, you know, there was a study that just came out this week, right, where researchers showed that you can infer a set of genetic diseases from facial recognition algorithms, right? So they're able to pretty accurately look at someone's photo and say, this person has X, Y, or Z genetic disease, right?
Really?
Now, that's for a certain set of diseases which are known to express in the face. It's very subtle. It's something that you wouldn't notice unless you're really well trained to look for it. Doctors look for it. But there's about 8% of the population that have a facial feature that's correlated with a genetic disease, it turns out. And computers can recognize that instantly, right? So you don't think when you walk into that Amazon store and it scans your face, right, that you're giving away medical information, right? But it turns out you are. And that's because, you know, we've built our regulations, we've built our expectations, we've built our social structures around the idea that there's these distinct domains in our lives that have different kinds of values, right? So, you know, we think medical information is one kind of thing, and we think, consumer data is another kind of thing. Machines don't think that way, right? They don't care. Machine learning is going to go out and it's going to grab whatever is available, and it's going to make inferences jumping across these domains that in our lived experience are really important, right? You know, you don't tell the grocer what you tell your doctor. You don't tell your doctor the same chit-chat you have with the grocer, right? But yet, here we are where we are building these algorithms that obliterate those critical
right.
social distinctions.
It's like this is their multiplication. It's like, it's just a multiplication that as you said, crosses domains and you just don't expect, right?
Yeah, and so we have this whiplash experience of it.
Right.
That feels like a privacy violation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, fundamentally that, right, like I said, that's the strength and the threat here is that we are, you know, we have these machines that make these inferences, they jump across domains, it turns inexpensive information, right, like a picture from a security camera, into expensive information. This person has a disease, and well, we can sell them a product, right? We are not at all prepared for what that means.
No, we're not. But the interesting thing when you say expensive, it's heretofore has been expensive, but by doing it by machine, it's actually not expensive anymore.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those,
right.
Those who can figure out how to do it by machine will have an enormous economic advantage because it's no longer resource intensive.
Right.
Now there's an accuracy problem, of course. Because a lot of these machines are built for advertising, right? Like any tiny marginal advantage in advertising is great. Because you think about like, you know, putting up a billboard or putting an ad in a magazine, you don't really know who's going to see it and how much time they're going to see it, right? So that, you know, the competitiveness in advertising is all about like being slightly more accurate than entirely inaccurate, right? So there's this way in which the tools that we've built are built for really, really marginal gains in accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Without a lot of attention paid to the consequences of the imprecision. One of the aspects of machine learning is that algorithms jump domains, right? So, for instance, the recidivism prediction algorithm called Compass, right, which got a lot of attention from that ProPublica investigation a couple years ago. You know, that was originally an algorithm used to predict earthquake aftershocks, right? So completely different domain, but it turns out there's enough similarities to how earthquakes behave, earthquakes and aftershocks to crime and subsequent crimes behave, that you could have an algorithm that just completely jumps domains. Now it evolves over time, and they would say it's probably pretty different, but the point is that, you know, again, we have this domain jumping feature where we think we're in category A, but and not category Z, but the machine doesn't care; it's going to jump.
So you've outlined already a couple of things that are troubling, obviously, about AI and what we're just not even prepared to think about. There's obviously unintended consequences here. So outline for us, maybe give us another example, and then outline for us, like, you know, why. Why is it that we need to be focusing on ethics? Why is it necessary?
I try to think of ethics as So if we look philosophically, right? Philosophically, ethics is about these, you know, wide open, unanswerable questions about what's the right thing to do, right? There's many different flavors to draw on. Some of it. You know, I mean, like my preferred background is existentialism and phenomenology and nihilism and, you know, sort of the European traditions where you're essentially grappling with what does it mean that we'll never have any answers. But when you're talking about an organization,
that's another subject. That's another talk.
Right. Yeah, that's another talk. An organization has to come up with an answer, right?
Yeah.
So really, in my opinion, the way to think of ethics is as a form of labor, right? It requires resources. It's the capacity to identify, track, understand, and mitigate the consequences of the technologies that you build and deploy, right? And in the end, there's, you know, things will remain unanswerable. But yet, in order to move forward with a product, you have to come up with, you know, some idea of what's good enough, right?
So it's risk mitigation. I mean,
there's
more risk here. So this is what you're trying to help people with, and is mitigating some of these risks.
That's part of it. Yeah, it's definitely part of it. You know, the thing about risk mitigation is ultimately, you know, risk mitigation is about risk to the company. I hope. I mean, of course, investing in ethics needs to be part of the business decision, right? Investing in this capacity needs to be part of the business decision. And, you know, we accept the fact that that means that there's profit motives that are involved, right? So it's in the family with risk mitigation, but yet we also kind of hope that that as tech companies get religion about ethics, it's also about protecting society, right? It's about protecting.
Right.
It's about protecting collective risk, not just corporate.
Okay, that's a really good point. And I think this is a great opportunity to look at, and you've got a great opportunity, and I can certainly, you know, see how we could partner with you on this in terms of just, it's not just about the ethics and data or ethics and tech or ethics and AI particularly. I mean, this is about ethics. We should be talking about this already. Like, what is tech's role in society? I mean, like, Microsoft just gave $500 million to housing in Seattle. I mean, maybe I don't even know. I don't know if that's enough or if that was. It seems like a nice gesture, but I mean, maybe it's not even enough. But it really goes to their role in society. And so this is not just about data. It's about how tech in general should be intermingling with society and frankly business's role in society. So before we get into that, I'm going to stop real quick and leave it open for questions because we've talked a lot about AI in general. We're starting into the role of ethics. I'm sure people have some questions. Maybe why we're even talking about this would be one of the questions. Why is this important? So if you just don't mind saying who you are and then your question or comment, that would be awesome. Who would like to start?
This is Robert in San Francisco.
Hey, Robert.
Hi. I love this dialogue so far, although I have to admit that parts of it are terrifying, as you pointed to. One thing that struck me, you said, you know, when companies get religion about this, and I'm curious what it is you think that will persuade the Googles and Facebooks and Amazon that dealing with ethics is at least as much of a priority as their bottom line, because there doesn't seem to be any indication from the news reports that that's a legitimate concern or perspective at this point. So I'm curious what you think will shift that, you know, short of legislation or other things that are external forces?
Yeah, that's a great question. I want to be fair to the tech companies in acknowledging that we actually don't know how to do this work yet, right? Because we haven't had enough time. You know, and it's not just about time. It isn't just about, like, oh, you know, we need to ponder this for 10 years. It's actually like there isn't a standard, right? There isn't, so I'm working on the IEEE P7000 standard, which is the first hybrid technical ethical standard in history, right? I'm the chair of the ethics subgroup for that. And so it's an ethical design standard for automated systems, right? So when that is released, maybe knock on wood later this year, that'll be the first time that there's actually a standard that there's now a leverage point where engineers and procurement and CEOs can say, like, okay, we know what it takes. Here's a community consensus about what the investment looks like. We can actually put a number on it, and now we can make a decision about its value, right? So, you know, like, we want organizations to be ethical, but we haven't figured out how to make ethics organizational, right? We haven't figured out, like, how do we actually turn these problems into tractable business decisions, right? It's really hard to see the point of investing in ethics if it all looks as downside, right? So as we have these new tools coming online, if it all looks just as cost, right? Mm-hmm. If we haven't figured out how do we turn this into, like, how do we figure out how we fit it in the other column too, right? Of course it's cost. But let's turn it from a cost to an investment, right? So that it becomes a good business decision.
And there's a return, yeah.
Yeah, we haven't figured out how to make it a return yet, rather than just scolding. I think 2019 is the year a lot of that comes online, actually.
Is it similar, Jake, to like what we're doing in corporate social responsibility? I mean, that would seem to me like an in. It doesn't sound that much different. Obviously, this is more specific. But can we follow along those footsteps? I mean, that's sort of what Microsoft's doing here. I mean, that's what they just did is an example of corporate responsibility, social responsibility.
Yeah. So I think the relationship between what we might call ethics and corporate social responsibility illustrates like a significant shortcoming in our dialogue, which is so this might be because many tech companies are just behave badly from top to bottom, but the behavior of the CEO mm-hmm. is not the same problem as the consequences of the technology, right?
Right.
The consequences of the consequences for the local housing market is not the same problem as machine bias,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But yet they all get called ethics. Somehow, right? And that's because, in the most general sense, ethics is just the question of what's right and wrong.
Right. I see your point in terms of this.
Yeah, I think a responsible company addresses all those layers, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
if we imagine the ideal company, it's going to respond to all those layers. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, why is it Microsoft's job to deal with housing policy, right? Like, that the government should tax appropriately. Put in the appropriate regulations, and
they tried.
They tried. Yeah, in
we
some places.
We did that here. Yeah, we did that here.
Yeah.
Robert, do you want to follow?
I have a sort of a bias in having been a molecular biologist at the dawn of the era of cloning, and the ethical implications that came online. So first of all, I'll say I'm delighted to hear that there actually is a group of people that are putting together some standard so that we will at least have a starting place for discussion and hopefully implementation. But I don't, I'm just skeptical as to, I don't see the same kind of reticence to err on the side of safety in the technology world that I felt in the science world, which of course was a much more academic and not a corporate profit-driven model, at least at that time, you know, in the mid-80s. So I think a legitimate concern that, you know, when it comes to a choice between bottom line profit and, quote, doing the right thing, you know, how many good companies will really end up being good?
As Homer Simpson once said, that is a honey doodle of a melon scratcher. that was Ned Flanders. That wasn't Homer. That was Ned Flanders. Are we just talking about capitalism here? Right? Is this just, you know, this is a feature of capitalism? Well, another angle here is, if we need regulation in order to rein in or, put the brakes on the behavior of tech companies, again, we're at this point where we don't even know what that looks like, right? Like we don't have a sense of what can be reasonably accomplished. And you know, if for instance, I think one of the ways we're going to be headed here is regulation through procurement control. So, for instance, when a municipality wants to buy a recidivism prediction tool for their court system or something similar, right? What we're going to see is some standards around transparency, validation, inspection, open source, right? Like what we're going to start to see is what are the demands that can reasonably be put on the market by the purchaser of the product, right? Mm-hmm. And those companies that have invested in ethics capacity as a form of work, right, as a form of we know how to turn ethics into problems that a business solves. Those are the companies that are going to excel in that space. And the companies that exist right now that haven't invested in that, that have gone willy-nilly into the market trying to do the venture capital nonsense of let's become a vertical monopoly right away. Those companies are going to fall by the wayside because they're not going to find customers, right? Like once there's markers of good behavior, then good behavior becomes valuable. And bad behavior mm-hmm. becomes less valuable. And mm-hmm. so, again, we're at this point where we know something's wrong, but we don't know what right looks like. Right? We don't know what best practice looks like.
The multiplication effect of what could happen, the burgeoning, I'm just having this imagination of all this stuff that can happen that it's almost I think there's this feeling of uncontrol, of out of control.
Yes.
I think that that's where people, and I think that that's fueled, of course, with the press around robots and everyone's going to lose their job and, the cars are going to hit us that are autonomous cars and all this stuff. But that actually, those things actually, the autonomous cars can be controlled better than this out-of-control data and privacy. I mean, I think that would take that problem over these other things in a minute. But, Robert,
the autonomous cars can, we imagine we can control them, but, again, this domain jumping problem, mm-hmm. it will be trivial for your autonomous vehicle to tap into the Facebook profiles of pedestrians, right? The machine is going to want to. It's going to want to make values decisions about human lives. And it's going to be we're going to find that domain jumping problem in a bunch of weird places that it's going to get ugly, in my opinion. I mean, mm-hmm. We saw that paper from a couple months ago that said, they did this big survey and had people rank who's more valuable, right? Like in an accident, who should die first, right? And the first people to die was always fat people, right? So it's trivial for a machine to learn that, to make guesses about BMI and decide that kill the fat person instead of the driver. So right, so the way these algorithms want to hoover up everything, and sometimes they do it duplicitously. They hide what they're doing. We're going to have some serious rules that limit, what kind of information can be used where, by whom. And mm-hmm. the way we regulate data in the U.S. right now doesn't do that at all.
Right. So tell us a little bit about most of what you're saying is that we're, we don't really know what we're getting into, and we have to start with these standards. So it sounds like you're helping set standards for the overall industry through these the organizations, and that's certainly one avenue. But tell us a little bit about when you go into a Facebook or into the big players that are have the money to invest in AI, and then also can buy the little companies. I mean, so they're already, you know, those are the Microsofts, the Amazons, the Facebooks, the Googles. Should we just start there? I mean, should we start with these bigger companies and go in and say, hey, you know, start asking those kinds of questions? Like, what are you doing as far as, is it just about AI, or do we just say just in general, like, what are you doing with data and technology? I mean, is it even a broader question?
I mean, as far as, like, my clientele goes, I'm often hired to do, it's not a general overhaul, right? I mean, part of this is, you know, like I said earlier, if we want organizations to be ethical, we have to figure out how to make ethics organizational. And so there's a lot of elements of this game that they're not going to hire an ethics consultant to do, right? Like corporate structure. So, you know, the way Zuckerberg's stocks are configured, he kind of has ultimate control but low visibility.
51%,
right? So,
yeah.
So there's, you know, they're not going to hire an ethicist to resolve that problem, but yet it is arguably most of their ethics problems are downstream from that, right? It's downstream from what are the chains of accountability. And who's responsible to whom, and who sees ethics as their problem. Often what I'm hired to do is something that's, you know, delimited. So it's build a training program. It is help them understand a particular investment. It is, you know, we're working for a liberal arts college to build a curriculum on basically how would liberal arts approach AI? And that's really fascinating. So think about all the non-technical jobs AI is going to require.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what does a social worker need to know about algorithms in order to, you know, mitigate the potential harm to people looking for services, looking for social services? Or what does a farmer need to know about algorithms in order to build an open source tool that is, you know, outside of the hands of the vertical seed monopoly? And so, you know, we get all kinds of different types of requests. But what I'm seeing right now, just in the past 3 months, we've seen companies, you know, hire or identify, you know, head of AI ethics.
Yeah,
so,
I've seen that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we've seen that at Workday, Salesforce, Intel, Accenture's investing a lot in AI ethics. Places, you know, Google has ethics, quote unquote, going on in like 5 or 7 places, but they don't have a coordinated effort. You know, they have an in-house ethicist right now from a friend of mine from Santa Clara. She's great. I'm really happy they took her on. But like, there's what we see is bits and pieces. We're starting to see hiring heads of departments that report up to the C level to have coordinated efforts, and that's great.
That's great.
We don't see anywhere yet, like, is an integrated top to bottom approach. I think maybe we will see it once they've, you know, now that there are people who are directly responsible. You know.
Is it your understanding and your belief that because you're really, you can play in all those places, but it seems like what you're focusing on is the engineers, like how, cause especially with machine learning bias, ML, machine learning bias, and what, you know, when they're coding, what are they thinking about?
Yeah. So,
is that
right,
even
like,
an ethical? I mean, is that even an ethical question? I mean, is it more?
That's where the work happens. That's where the work happens, right? So, you know, when the CEO gets religion, and the CEO goes to the department heads and says, "Go do ethics." Department heads go to the project manager and says, "Go do ethics." And the project manager is at their weekly scrum and they say, go do ethics. And their team says,
with a question
what
mark?
Does that mean?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's great that we have, you know, this sort of building capacity up at the leadership level, building commitment up at the leadership level, but I think the frontier here is, like, how do we make ethics an everyday engineering problem?
Mm-hmm.
And that means, you know, workflows. That means integrating it into performance evaluation, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means making, you know, recognizing and rewarding people for doing good ethical work and showing how that leads to better product. I am committed to the idea that, you know, ethics work leads to better product. But what we need to see from companies is figuring out what that means every day, not just, you know, sets of principles that a CEO signs on to.
So give us an example of that. So, like, because I mean, I'm not an engineer, and I know people on the call, most of them are not either. But I can surmise what it means when someone's coding. But I'm curious, like, what are the decisions to get to diminish? I don't think maybe you can eliminate, but diminish machine learning bias. How does an engineer sit there and figure that out, even?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, you know, being close to the data, right, and recognizing that the data represents people. So here's an example that we've used before in training programs. So imagine you are working for the machine vision team at a a social media network, you are trying to train an algorithm to recognize sporting events, right? So you want it to recognize when someone's playing badminton or going skiing or running a race, right? Because then you can, you can automatically tag it, right? So that's really useful. It's also a useful accessibility feature because, then your people that use your service but have visual impairments can your service can be useful for them because it can say, here's a picture of Sue running, right? There's all kinds of reasons why that sort of automatic tagging makes a better product, right? Like maybe it suggests stickers or it congratulates you or, you know, whatever it is. Machine vision really is, like, it's kind of one of the frontiers in social media right now. So imagine you're working on that team, you're working on sporting events, and you realize that there's this, you know, you've gone through a million photos. You've run your algorithm through a million photos, and what you've done is you've selected out the photos that are tagged with, hashtags that are common to racing. So #5K, #personal best. But you realize there's a subset of those that the computer doesn't recognize as running a race. And you look at that subset, and they're all wheelchair racers, right? So the algorithm has mistakenly learned that racing requires movement of legs, right? So what do you do, right? What's the solution to that? Well, it turns out that actually the solution to that is to add more bias into the data set. It's to add an unrepresentatively high number of wheelchair racers to the data set for racing, the training set for racing. But what that means is you need an engineer who's savvy enough about social inclusion as a value, right, as a company value. You need to have given them time to think through it. You need to have given them the resources to, tune the algorithm in that way. And you need to have them to be technically savvy enough to fix it. And so all of those are like I said, they're investments in capacity.
Tuning in. It's the tuning in that's difficult.
Right. That's a common sort of technical problem that engineers deal with all the time when they're working with algorithms, right? It's it's checking for false negatives. But if the company hasn't prioritized inclusion as a value and told their engineers we're giving you time and the expectation that you're going to work to make this as inclusive as possible, then it may never be noticed. And you roll out a product that doesn't serve a chunk of people.
Yeah, I thought it's interesting. I thought where you were going with that was the idea of, like, you know, a million photographs, you know, 80% being male, you know.
Yeah.
That happens not even in sports, but it happens in, like, you know, Getty Images and a lot when you're going through a lot, it's a lot more male images kind of thing. And somebody can correct for that.
Yes. Yeah. There are ways to correct for it. The question is, are you going to invest in the value of inclusion?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to simply say this is what the data set is? Right. It's easier just to say this is what the data set is. It takes money and time to make a better product and make it inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, have we figured out how to make that a good business decision because you end up with a better product, right? What are the markers of good behavior that are available? A lot of times good behavior doesn't necessarily get recognized. So how do we reward the companies that make that decision to invest in the capacity to make good decisions?
Right.
And that's where I feel like we're at. Right now is figuring out those moments and building them piecemeal, testing them. You know, we need to be forgiving for companies that try things and don't get it right. We need to praise companies that go public with these sort of efforts, right? There's a lot of risk for that, so we need to recognize that these are sort of collective problems. We're going to be experimenting. We're going to try different varieties of things, and eventually we're going to figure out how to, incentivize making more ethical product.
Right. I will say that the conference I was at earlier this year, I guess it was maybe October, AI and Innovation Conference, machine bias was like predominant in most of the discussions, which was nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean,
all the speakers brought it up, which is great, you know.
Yeah, so I have some things to say about that too, which is, I mean, machine bias is not that hard to solve for. It turns out that fairness is way harder. So I'm giving a talk at the FAT conference, the FAT Star conference. So FAT is fairness algorithm. Fairness, accountability, and transparency. That is sort of the conference that kind of created this interdisciplinary field. And I'm getting a tutorial talk at the conference in a couple of weeks discussing the difference between we often conflate bias and unfairness. It's really important to actually distinguish those because bias is a feature of technical systems, and unfairness is a feature of human systems.
Yep.
Unfortunately, in the English language, those two things are really conflatable. And then when you get, they're both meanings of the word fair.
Right.
They're both meanings of the word bias.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of great tools and a lot of great research coming out right now about unbiasing data sets and unbiasing algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't have is people investing in the capacity to think about fairness, because fairness is one of those big, wide-open questions.
Right, which is where we come in.
Yeah.
Like, this is why you and I keep, like, intersecting, because you can't just have the machine do it. You have to have somebody make a decision, right?
Yes. Yep. And
anyway.
Yep. If we only invest in resolving the technical problem, we're in 5 years we're going to be back at square one, which is like,
right,
you don't know how to deliberate about these values questions.
Right.
And it'll be great to have unbiased data sets and unbiased algorithms, but it won't resolve the problem of What's interesting right now, I think, you know, corporations have always had to grapple with values problems. But the thing that AI does, like, why is this an active topic right now? Why wasn't corporate ethics, corporate values, such an intense debate for Xerox, right? Or, you know, Microsoft in the early days, right? Like, why does Microsoft now have a data ethics issue? Why are they investing in that? Why do they have board meetings about it? It's because what these machines do is force us to make values explicit.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So where we could get by before on, hiring people with good values and good character and smudging around the edges of values decisions and following where the market is going, that doesn't work anymore because what these machines require us to make explicit value statements. We have to code values into the algorithm.
Yeah.
It's the only way they work. So you have
that's
to
awesome.
Get explicit about it.
Well, we're going to end on that because that actually is like, when we're answering the question about why we're even talking about this. This is why we're talking about it because it's just we have to make it explicit. We have to actually code it in. So thank you, Jake, so much for being with us, for kicking us off for this year, and really giving us some insights and answers, but more actually giving us more questions to think about. So really, really appreciate it very much. Again, Jake's website is ethicalresolve.com. His Twitter is @undersequoias, and he literally is as we speak. So thanks again, Jake. Let me talk a little bit about our next Wise Talk, which is in February. We don't have the exact date and time yet, but we're going to have Sanjay Srivastava. He's the Chief Digital Officer at Genpact. I know him because I did see him speak at this conference I was at in October, and he's going to have a lot of interesting things to say about AI and society, and Genpact's doing some really interesting things. So please join us for that. We'll get that information out to you. And again, Jake, thank you. I want to keep talking. It's just so interesting. So thanks again. Thanks, everybody, for joining us, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks, Sue, and thanks for everyone who joined.
Thanks again, Jake. Bye now.